your mouth there. It looks like the caller has stopped calling. Try calling again, caller. I've turned down the phone so I can't hear it, so I have to occasionally refer to the light on my, control board. That's it, yes, on the control board. And, Mike, if you see this thing lighting up, please
I'll tap you shortly.
Or sing, maybe a little song.
Strangers in the Night.
There you go. Now, we could actually do a little singing here, but perhaps as little as possible. But the sections of the camping ordinance that make it criminal to sleep between 11 and 8:30 in the morning.
Well, as you know, it just seemed insane to me that we would have kind of this duality, the schizophrenia when it comes to this particular issue, that on one side we could say it's illegal for people to sleep, which is a normal humanly bodily function necessary to survive, and at the same time we're not going to provide people who are in need with the resources to have a safe and legal place to sleep. When I got in the business community involved, the Mission Street Business Association, the Downtown Association, the Chamber, aware of this issue, and also the fact that 20 to 25% of these people are working poor people that work for the businesses in this community, many with children, living in vehicles and living in our campgrounds and unofficial areas of the city as always. It just seemed an oxymoron that we could not have a situation where people who are need of sleep would have at least wouldn't be arrested for the act of sleeping. They may be doing other things that they could be arrested for, but definitely not for the act of sleeping. This just became a human rights issue with me, as I know it is with you. And I've continued to move forward on that issue. To my dismay and frustration, I'm seeming to get nowhere with it. I'm having council members tell me we can't use political capital on an issue like this, or we don't want to do anything unless we know what we're going to do, or even just the mere fact, and I think that's what you've been lobbying for many of the life work, just put the friggin' thing on the agenda. And if you'd vote against it, then we know at least you voted against it. If you vote for it, then you voted for it. At least it gets on the agenda. There's an opportunity for the public to comment on the decriminalization of the act of sleep. And let the chips fall where they may. If they vote against us, they vote against us. But just the idea that these guys are so terrified that they won't even put it on the agenda is just unbelievable to me. And I think it's one of the reasons why I got involved in district elections. Because as I see time and time again when you go before the city council, if you don't have someone that you can go to and hold accountable, nothing gets done. And each one of them passes the buck to the other, as we're seeing now with the Action Town Hall that we're trying to put together. No, I'm not handling that. He's handling that. Oh, well, I'm handling it, but I'm also doing this other. You know, there's no accountability. And I think this is just frustrating that we just can't seem to get this issue move forward. And we're hoping in this latest round of strategies, where we're bringing in about 40 religious community leaders for an Action Town Hall on June the 29th, and people that are involved in this issue, homeless people that are living this issue every day, and hopefully some political leaders who in theory many of them have espoused that they want to do something on the issue but never seem to get to the table.
You're talking about political hacks like the Marty Wormhout, the supervisor, Tim Fitzmaurice, the mayor, or are you talking about leaders in the community like Donna Dice, who you apparently talked to earlier today, or the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz? Who do you mean by leaders?
Well, I think we've got a variety of leaders. We've got the community leaders that are unelected, such as Donna and others, and we've got the public officials that are elected, that were elected in part because they made a commitment. You know, here's Tim Fitzmaurice, the mayor, who's a member of the Green Party, who committed to the Green Party criteria on the issue of homelessness, and has been mayor for, 6 months now, and has done zip.
And on the council for 2 years behind that.
So exactly.
Two and a half years now he's been there. Yeah.
And I remember when these three were campaigning. I remember being up at the university because I was working for Rod and Linda. And they were being very adamant with the students. Oh, you know, we're going to do something about this and that issue. And one of the issues they talked about was dealing with the camping ban, the sleeping portion of the camping ban, dealing with the homeless issue. And to date, we've gotten a few misfires. You know, to Keith Sugar's credit, we did move forward with establishing some safe and sleeping zones. We had city time and dedicated staff. We had a number of meetings about it.
But you were a part of that special Mayor Sugar's special group on that, as I remember.
Yeah, and then it kind of got sabotaged by another council member who...
You don't mean Catherine Byers, do you? Or are you talking about Michael Rodkin?
I'm talking probably more like Michael, who goes on, you know, KCBS or whatever the heck it was, and tells the world that, oh, we've repealed the camping ban, or left that impression anyway, and then we end up inundated with folks. And it got the normal reaction that it did that we were afraid of in the first place. Without proper planning, without proper execution, without getting the affected areas involved in the decision-making process and in the planning process, you're going to get a backlash, and that's exactly what we got.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the mythology spread by the San Francisco Chronicle, Michael Hernandez, Michael Vasquez of the downtown, I guess the Downtown Business Association, and no doubt some folks from the Harvey West Association and others who were apprehensive about the two safe sleeping zones that were very, very much reduced, but had been still proposed after a 10-day coffee clatch, actually, at the city council offices that began in May, as well as a many months long fast by David Silva and other supporters, and various protests such as the Pie and the Pusser Award from April of City
Which
Council.
I never could understand why you hit yourself in the face with that pie.
Well, you know, I think we were too sensitive to give it to poor Mike Rotkin, who really, I would say, amply deserved it, as well as Catherine Byers, who certainly should have gotten a piece of the pie. And who knows, maybe in the future. It was very tempting to provide Mayor Fitzmaurice with a pie when he came out of the court, but unfortunately there was no baker in the hallway, so we were stuck. And Tim got away without a taste of his own medicine, so to speak. So we had the situation last spring where not only the lobbying of activists, but you were in there going to meeting after meeting. In January and February of 2000, you went to Harvey West, you went to associations on the west side.
Natural Bridges Group, yeah.
You were going down trying to, you were talking to the people who would be, one would think, would be least likely to be enthusiastic about any changes in the current camping ordinance or decriminalization of sleeping in the sleeping sections of that ordinance. And you were actually able to be persuasive in certain respects. And also, what did you find in those meetings?
Well, I think I found that, you know, when you get folks involved from the get-go, that they feel like they're part of the process, then they're more inclined to be acceptable to what is being proposed. They obviously understood the nature of the problem. One of them I know of in the Harvey West area had already had a homeless family in their parking lot, and they were applauding the behavior of these folks and also the fact that they were acting kind of an additional security in the evenings at a time when they're running 24-hour shifts in their operation. We had similar situations out in Natural Bridges. But the whole idea of it being programmed and planned with porta-potties in the right places, with trash receptacles in the right places, with the homeless resource officer having the correct pamphlet to give to people who are parked in the wrong places, here's where to go, with the kind of codes and enforcement we were looking for to manage it and to be effective, the businesses were more receptive to it. With just opening it up, you know, carte blanche, that gets them scared and they act on their paranoias and their perceptions and not on their facts.
They're more vulnerable to paranoid appeals by people like Rotkin, people like DeFreitas of the Downtown Neighbors Association and others who were just hostile to any kinds of changes, characterizing homeless people as child molesters, dangerous to women in the neighborhood, and so forth.
Well, the sad part about it is it's just not on this issue. We have this NIMBYism attitude. I had access to a study that was done by the American Society for Applied Anthropology. Mm-hmm. And the professor involved in the research was looking at communities to determine if more conservative or more liberal communities were more likely to be NIMBY. And it turned out, to his somewhat surprise, and that the more liberal the community, the more NIMBY it was.
Liberal fascists, I'm afraid, is the deal.
And so, you know, it seems like we want it if we've got it, but not if we want them to have it. So it's just a real frustration to me that this should have been an issue that should have been behind us and not
way behind us.
Not stuck here.
Start
in the 21st century dealing with a place for people who are in many cases not any fault of their own. I mean, I remember the family that I dealt with that came by my office. I mean, she had ended up diagnosed with cancer, had lost her job because she was unable to work. Her husband was working a full-time job and a part-time job. Their landlord, in talking about the whole issue of housing, was in a position to raise their rent from $900 to $1,400. They struggled as long as they could. They finally got to the point where they couldn't afford the rent. They were living in the back end of an old Ford with a camper shell on
and
the back.
When was this?
This was a family that I met some months ago.
Right, so this, and they're still in that position? Or
I think we got them into the Page Smith's house, and now I think they're finally in housing. Unfortunately, the last word I got, they moved out of the community in order to find that housing.
Huh, yeah, it's too expensive to deliver. Of course, that's the solution that folks will tell you. Well, if you can't afford it here, get out of town. And You know, we're going to be segueing back and forth between these issues of the sleeping ban and the other issue that we've been kind of talking about a lot in these shows for the last couple of weeks: rent control or some kind of rent stabilization, some way of stopping unbridled profiteering and the huge rent increases that are just hitting Santa Cruz like lightning bolts, one after another. And we've seen this group of Latino residents from the Riverside apartments coming to city council and, you know, properly lamenting the fact that rents have been raised 100% or more in the last year, and they just can't afford it, and they're about to be evicted, and council's doing these sort of, oh, you know, we're going to try to help you, and so forth. I see this as an adjunct to the Fitzmaurice's sole source monopoly provider Mercy Charities housing junket that he wants to pass, and he's trying to use this as the stick to frighten people with, and there's no question that the profiteering landlords are a real question. The real question is, but should the money, all 5 years of affordable housing money in the city, be dumped into a demolition of existing housing and a reduction of the housing stock just because Mercy Charities Housing has an old plan it wants to incorporate, and because they've got Catherine Byers on their side and numerous other councilors?
Well, you know what redevelopment is in the Beach Flats area, don't you?
Tell me.
Redevelopment is where they tear down buildings, eliminate parking, and put in bike lanes. So this is really the extent of, when you look at what has really happened, that's what's happening. I'm very concerned about the issue of putting $5.5 million the next 4 or 5 years of our money into one project.
The Dolphin Lee project that we're talking about.
And because there's more evidence on a national basis that shows when you develop mixed income properties, you can actually get more units over the long haul, and you don't put, in essence, stigmatize all the poor people live in that one space over there, because we've now decided this is the affordable housing area where you're going to get to live if you happen to be poor. I just think that's...
Well, you have to be Latino, too, it looks like to me. I mean, because, mm-hmm. First of all, I mean, again, they have to serve all the people whose housing they're destroying, and they're destroying, well, at least there are two buildings, the Lee Apartments and the Dolphin Apartments, who have several hundred people in them, and of course they've already destroyed the Rex Court Apartments without even... allowing for those people who were, in essence, evicted by Canfield several years ago, sent on their way, and what looks like a behind-the-scenes deal with Seal Cirillo. The property was, you know, purchased and then demolished in such a way that they didn't have to pay relocation money to these people who were evicted. Maybe it was 60 or 70 people who lived there, I'm not sure. It's just sordid stuff.
And the sad part about it is this is happening all over this country. My brother, who lives in Tucson, who has traveled worldwide on human rights issues, he couldn't understand why, or I couldn't understand why, when he had problems in his own backyard, why he could be spending all this time overseas. And he finally got involved in his local community and found that here's a area, because that, like in the 60s and 70s, we built a lot of affordable housing units in certain areas with a 3 and 4 and 5 and 10 story high-rise units where we put them all in one space. Those units are now old and dilapidated, and here's the city of Tucson tearing them down and doing essentially what the city of Santa Cruz does. Well, we'll give you the money to run, and then, or we'll set up a criteria for you to be able to qualify for relocation money, and of course getting written guarantees. Well, it's in the law, but they never seem to be able to provide us with where in the law those things are. So it seems to be not just unique to Santa Cruz, it seems to be epidemic throughout this country. And at the same time, the United States, which is a member of the World Bank, sets a very specific criteria on a national basis when you're moving indigenous people. I mean, you've got to be able to actually provide them with new housing, land that's comparable to the land they were on. You can't bust the kids out of the neighborhood. You can't say, well, by the way, we don't have any affordable housing here. We've got it. We've got some homes in whatever the heck it is, Hayward or
Fresno,
Salinas.
Fresno.
Yeah. And if you want to move there, that's on the international basis, that is just criminal. But we seem to accept it here in this country. And unfortunately, that's what's happened to a lot of the local people here who are in the poor and are dealing with the issue of redevelopment the way it's being managed.
Yeah, I kind of ran on the internet the other night, and I found this story by Ben, Bakdikian, who's a sort of an expert in media, but he's got some interesting things to say about income policy in the U.S. I took a few quotes. The United States is unique among the world's advanced industrial societies, France, Germany, the United Kingdom, for example. It has retained a dubious exception for so long that a poverty class in this country is now seen as normal, inevitable, and with parallel media unconcern, invisible. Who are the American poor, and are they really poor? Government statistics periodically adjust the poverty level in the country to reflect changes in the cost of living. In 1999, for example, a family of three with a household income of $13,880 or less was classified as living in poverty. Of the 32 million Americans in poverty, 72% were in families. These include one of every five American children. These are not poor because they lack Cuisinards and BMWs. They are poor because they lack enough food, shelter, and access to other elementary living conditions in any modern society. By the 1980s, the number of poor Americans began climbing noticeably. By 1998-99, the average poor child was further below the poverty line than he or she was in 1979. Is this some rabid socialist writing here? What do you think?
No, I think, unfortunately, it's the state of the fact.
A hint of what's changed is that homeless people, a minority of the total poor, are homeless, even though, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, 64% of them have jobs, some of them two jobs, but they are still poor by government standards. No affluent democracy has been able to house its low-wage families by depending on private real estate industry. This is something that you may take issue with, Michael. Government-subsidized low-income housing has been found indispensable if all are to be housed in minimally decent homes and apartments. Before 1979, the U.S. subsidized 200,000 such low-income units a year. In the early 1980s, and the new fervor for shifting everything possible to the free market, subsidized low-income housing subsidies were cut by 92%. That is the central reason we suddenly had a permanent beggar class and families living in the streets. Few readers or TV news watchers were ever told the basic reasons why our homeless happened out of nowhere. True or false, Michael?
Very much true.
The majority of the poor are not mentally ill. They are mentally sound, non-addicted individuals and families, but they remain poor. According to the Department of Housing and Urban Affairs, HUD, from 1985 to 1993, the private market for affordable housing dropped another 20%. And according to the Journal of Housing and Community Development, only 33% of Americans eligible by law for federal housing actually can find such housing. The Journal's 1997 issue reported, with affordable housing out of reach for growing numbers of low-income Americans, the housing crisis can only be expected to worsen. The recent actions by Congress have further disenfranchised an already disadvantaged segment of the American family. By 1995, there were 1.3 million low-cost housing units available for 2.6 million low-income renters, as shown by a survey by the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Yet, in the same time period, according to the National Association of Realtors, the median price for a single-family house rose 45%. With low-cost rental apartments unattractive to the real estate industry and failure of the needed government subsidies for what the private market prefers to reject, the mystery of both the homeless and the impoverished 32 million Americans is not very mysterious. What do you think?
You're right. What can I say? I mean, I've often wondered, you know, I think part of the problem was when these big cuts were being made, there was this perception that we had fraud going on. There was a perception that, well, those people could, you know, they can get jobs, they can do something else. What the heck's the problem with them? And this attitude by policymakers, well, I made it, so can you. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, not everybody is that fortunate. And too often, it's because of lack of education or lack of opportunity, or just circumstances beyond these folks' control, and they find themselves behind the eight ball, and then they get into the spiral, which usually runs downhill, not uphill, and to a point where, you know, by the time they're in their 30s and the 40s, they've got little or no hope at all. And I think that's something that you see when you get involved with the homeless issue, is you see people who too often have just finally given up hope. And hope, to me, is one of the passions that keep us going and make us alive and give us a uniqueness as human beings. And when you don't have that, because, you know, you can't find a job because you don't have a resident, you don't have a resident because you can't get a phone, and it goes on and on and on, you're stuck behind the eight ball. I've often wondered if we spent the money that we should be spending in just offering some type of a simplified subsidy program that would say, okay, you know, you need an apartment, we got, you know, X number of vacancies out here, the landlord charges, you know, $1,000 or whatever heck it is, you can afford 200, we're going to give you the other 800 bucks, and somehow simple system instead of what we're doing now where we have enormous amounts of bureaucracies involved. I was reading a report on the internet about who makes the money in low-income housing. Who really benefits? It's not the poor. It's the people who actually build them and supply them with products and services. The guy puts in the refrigerator.
Poverty pimps in the middle is the deal.
But, you know, they're just doing what they're doing because, you know, hey, you're going to build a house, I'll provide you with a refrigerator. I don't care if you're building it for an affordable using or for a $10 million home. And the sad part about it is that the people in the middle is what kind of concerns me, that the bureaucrats that, you know, draw these huge amounts of salaries in many cases have set enormous amounts of rules for people to comply with. In some cases, I was involved with some issues here in Santa Cruz, and I was looking through the criteria and the way these people were being treated. You're almost assumed to be a criminal to start off with. And that kind of assumption...
Well, if you're poor, what other assumption is there?
But that's just, you know, it... There may be some validity to it with demonstrated performance.
In this country, if you can't make it, obviously you're either disabled or you're, you know, some kind of a crook, right?
Yeah, well, we see a lot of crooks at the top.
I don't like that kind of talk.
Well, hey, Mr. Nixon.
Well, Mr. Nixon was an exception, dishonorable
exception.
And
now Mr. Bush is falling in his place.
Well, Mr. Bush, this is not my opinion, I want you to know. This man is obviously a radical. We're talking to Michael Schmidt, who is also running for the Board of Stupid Vipers. I'm sorry, Supervisors. I got to get the right name here. Board of Supervisors. And he will be running against our dear old liberal supervisor, the woman who used to arrest people for asking for blankets at night and for serving free food, Marty Wormhout. Now, you have been raising this homeless issue around the sleeping van for quite a while, and not just people have been saying, oh, he's going to run for something. You know, he's raising these issues. He's got his eye on some political goal, and here you are running for supervisor. Is this just some plot? I mean, you picked up this popular sleeping van issue, which everybody loves you for, and this is going to carry you to victory, right? You're going to end the sleeping ban, and that's going to make all these wealthier people kind of carry you through the streets on their shoulders.
Yeah, right.
So what is this, Michael? Why are you going after Marty Wormhout? And try to focus a bit on her fine handling of homeless issues. And I mean, actually...
I think because she hasn't handled homeless issue. Mm-hmm. If you look at the number of homeless people in our community 8 years ago when she took office, and the number of homeless people we have here today, it's skyrocketed. When you look at the amount of services that we provide... to people who are in need, and I mean need-based services, we've actually gone downhill. This woman is single-handedly responsible for $20 million worth of affordable housing money that we could have had from the state, regardless of what numbers you may agree the state says we have to build or not build, that could have gone and helped people that would have been had a house or shelter, but they don't have because of this situation.
So why wasn't the $20 million made available, and what was Marty's responsibility here?
Well, you know, we've got this old word, growth. We're afraid of the G word. And so if we, you know, sort of like the idea, if we create congestion, maybe they won't want to be here. If we don't build housing, we don't provide services for the people who already live here, well, that'll encourage fewer people to move here. Unfortunately, that's kind of sticking your head in the sand and wondering why people can still see your butt in the air. It's going to happen anyway. And what we're seeing now is more folks that are using Santa Cruz as a second home market. We've seen the dot-comers come in here and pay big cash money for homes. We've seen, and I guess my concern is that the quality of life in the 21st century in Santa Cruz should not mean that our children have to quadruple or double up in order to find a place to live, to afford a place to live. Our seniors shouldn't have to move out of this community. Our homeless shouldn't be considered criminals for sleeping at night. And our family shouldn't have to move out because they can't afford to live here. And this is the legacy that this individual and others in her political ideology have left us with. On one hand, we've got this great environment. Great environment. Mm-hmm. But we have a decay of human suffering that's occurring below that beautiful environment that has made it extremely difficult. The second least affordable city in America is Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz, the second least affordable. This, why not New York or Boston or Chicago? No, it's Santa Cruz, California. We have the city of Santa Cruz, to its credit, has done a reasonably good job at building affordable housing. And over 10% of their units, I think it's actually about 12% of their units, are considered affordable by whatever criteria they like to measure by. But at the county level, we have a dismal record. We have downzoned property when we could have had affordable housing, and on and on and on. Take that call.
Hi, you're on free radio.
Hello, Robert. How you doing today?
Good.
That's good.
Sounds like Terrible Tony.
Yeah. Well, I watched a terrible incident a few minutes ago.
What did you watch?
Watched a woman get beat up.
By?
By her partner.
By her partner?
Yep.
Wow. Did you intervene? I know you're a man who has you're disabled and you're sightless, right?
Yep.
Did you say, all right, I'm going to blunder into this? How could you watch this if you were sightless?
Well, I can hear it, and I heard it and everything, because I was in the hallway.
Oh, okay, so has everything calmed down, or is...
No, the cab driver was there, and he called the cops.
Uh-huh. Did they help, or did they hurt?
They helped.
Oh, that's good. Often I'm critical of police, as you know, and when they help,
not this
gotta give them credit.
This time, I think this guy is going to get what he deserves, hopefully.
Right. Well, did you call in to give us the update on that, or have you been listening to our show?
No, I'm not listening to the show at the moment. The radio's off, but I'm going to turn it on I'm just calling to vent, basically.
Okay, well, you vented, and I want to thank you. And are you still doing a show on Free Radio?
Yeah, I still am.
What time is that?
Every Saturday from 10 to 12.
And you cover what subjects?
I do sci-fi stuff.
Sci-fi, yeah, some heavy sci-fi stuff for those who would like the... actually, I'm a sci-fi fan myself. Well, thank you for calling, Tony, and call again if you want to talk about the topics we're talking about.
Well, when you're talking specifically about... homelessness, medical cannabis, or anything like that?
Well, we got Michael Schmidt here in the studio. He's the man that they can't shame, shun, or shut up, I guess that's the way to put it.
Good.
Talking shit with Schmidt, that's what we're doing.
All right. I think I'll listen in.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
So, yeah, well, that's call in 427-3772. You're on Free Radio Santa Cruz listening to Bad Boy Bathrobes, Pierre Robert Norris, and, of course, Michael Schmidt, supervisorial candidate, is the Chamber of Commerce CEO. No longer the spokesperson, however, for the Chamber of Commerce. Have you been demoted there, Michael? What's going on here?
Well, the board passed a resolution, and rightly so, that having a CEO that's a candidate for a political office, they've got to be sensitive to, and we've got 935 members, and not all of them are going to agree with us anyway. And I think it was a prudent move on the Chamber's board part. It also gives me the opportunity, as I told him the other day when we had the board meeting, I had my attorney look over the resolution. I said, you know, you've put me in a unique position where I can, at least legally, not many employees can do this, can criticize their employer and their policies and be perfectly legitimate in doing it. Though there's many, there's very few things I think I would criticize about the way the Chamber's doing, because since I've been here, we've tried to change the paradigm from what was good for business is good for the community to what good for the community is good for business. And I think the Chamber's leadership role in trying to move forward the safe and legal zones and places for people to sleep and the year-round shelter is an example of that change in paradigm. And so consequently, I'm really proud to be part of this organization. You know, an old liberal Democrat, a guy who walked precincts for John Kennedy at 15, never would have envisioned I'd be the CEO of a Chamber of Commerce at 55,
but
nevertheless...
Talk about your downward declensions here.
It's true. But
what about rent control? Now, rent control is actually what I was promising some of our listeners.
That's what we were supposed to talk about.
We were supposed to talk about rent control, but here we are, halfway through the show, haven't even mentioned it. And, you know, probably Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz activist Donna Dice hasn't been able to come in, but I hope she's listening and is all set to call in to
she
call you.
She was going to try to reach you. I had a good conversation with her today.
Well, I know that Donna said that the one point of disagreement that she had with you, you don't like to say you favor rent control, but it sure sounds like you do. Do you favor a proposal that would require landlords to... get some kind of consent from a city or county agency before raising their rents above a certain percentage?
I think what I told Donna, that where I would come down on this issue, especially after looking at the data, and the state of New Jersey is one of the states that has the most cities over 10,000 with rent control, is first of all I'd like to try to see if we can come up with some incentives. Are there incentives that we could put into place to encourage landlords not to create enormous increases in their rents? If that's not working, then can we work with them to set up some type of voluntary system where landlords would work to ensure that they keep their rents in line with maybe the CPI index? I mean, it's not just affecting individuals
that's
in homes, it's affecting
index.
Businesses as well. We have many businesses in this community that are on a rent on a month-to-month basis, and they've been hit with huge rent increases because they can get it. And then if that doesn't work, one thing we talked about with Donna was, is it possible, I don't even know if it's legal, that, you know, you got to register your car, you got to register your dog, you're even supposed to register your bicycle, why not have landlords register with the city, and at the time, and then a pamphlet put together that explains to tenants what their rights are, what support organizations are there for them, what they're entitled to, and what their responsibilities are, and that's the responsibility of a landlord at the time you sign that lease or that contract, that you provide them with that. Just like you get a full disclosure when you do a home loan or a car loan, you get the truth in lending disclosure.
But you
tells
don't
you
have many rights is the problem.
Well,
you've
got some, but most people don't have it. And then if that doesn't work,
how many people have emigrated, died, or simply jumped into trash cans as temporary quarters while we're waiting for these different proposals to work? I mean, what's your time frame here?
Well, I would like to see it move very quickly because, one, I think that there is a recognition on the more responsible landlords that there's some out there that are just you know, given a bad name to the rest, which is kind of typical for what happens in the world anyway. Mm-hmm. Two bad guys make the rest 99 look
bad. But let's say you proposed incentives. Now, how much time are you going to give them with incentives? 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years?
Well, I think... That I don't know, because I don't know what kind of incentives we'd come into place and how long does it take to really demonstrate we're getting anywhere with them. I also would, you know, when we had the water issue here and the droughts in 76, 77, mm-hmm. We had a drought review board, a water review board. So if you wanted to get, you needed more water for a particular reason, you went before the review board. Mm-hmm. Something like that, that's maybe, again, along with the registration idea.
Mandatory or voluntary?
I think it would have to be mandatory in this case. Mm-hmm. That if you're raising your rent over a certain percentage that the community feels is acceptable, if that's 3% or 5% or 10%,
sure,
whatever.
Sure sounds like rent control to me there, Michael.
Well,
I think you're under arrest. The Chamber of Commerce will have you placed in custody and taken to the rear of the room.
Well,
next.
Hold on. It just the idea that there's some... I would say somebody representing the renters, tenants' rights groups. I went through it here myself. I mean, we lived in Aptos. Our landlord one day is charging us $1,100 a month, and then he says, I'm raising your rent to $1,700 a month. Now, state law says now he has to give me 60 days' notice to do that. Well, he did. He gave me 60 days' notice. I then gave him 30 days' notice. And he did it because he said, I can do it because the market will bear it. We went around to our cul-de-sac, an area where we live. We found the average rent was $1,100. A few were paying $1,400. None were paying less than that, $1,100. But here's a landlord who lived in Fresno, nice guy, but he realized, and then we learned later that part of the motivation was he was going to remodel two of the units that were in where we are. He wanted to put a huge deck on one of them, and he wanted to do a major remodel of the two units that were there. He needed money to do that. Well, you know, instead of holding back money to invest and do that.
I like money to play the ponies myself.
Well, whatever motivation is. But mm-hmm. I think we have I don't know the actual percentage, but I've got to believe that the overwhelming majority of our landlords who are very responsible people who don't want to shaft their renters.
Now, that was, of course, I understand, a point of, shall we say, difference between you and Donna Dice. Donna, time to call in, 427-3772, if you want to join this conversation. Michael only has another 20 minutes here in the studio before he rushes off to another one of his interminable, endless sequence of meetings. So what about this? You know, you think...
Well, I'm just saying, she obviously, from where she's sitting, she sees the problem on a daily basis. You know, if you were talking to me about business issues, I see it on a daily basis, and I'd probably be much more informative. I would have to, you know, concede. Maybe if she's saying it's 50%, then maybe that's the 50%.
She's concerned, as I understand it, and I haven't talked to her about this in terms of specific stats, but on-site landlords, she says, in some cases, are just as bad as the absentee landlords, and so we have to...
I would agree.
...consider that
I
as well.
I think that's probably... And with people who are dealing with that issue, they obviously are aware of it. But I would hate to think that it's the majority. God, I'd hope not.
All right. You're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. This is Donna.
Donna Dice.
Hello, Donna. Welcome.
Hi. How are you doing?
We're just having more fun here at City Hall than you'd ever imagine.
Hey, man. I wish we were at City Hall. But actually, I'm glad we're not at City Hall. I'd be arrested if we were. It's just not. I'm barred from City Hall, as you know.
Oh, you still can't go there yet?
I can't go to City Hall within 50 yards unless I'm there for a scheduled meeting or on business at an office that is open. I guess we could schedule a meeting ourselves.
That's
and claim
right.
That was a meeting, but
mm-hmm.
I think they might not go for that.
Yeah.
Donna, you're the head of the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz?
Yes.
And you've been working with this organization. Well, how long has it existed?
About 5 years.
And you've been putting in, as I understand it, great amounts of energy, going down informing people when their landlords are trying to kick them out, going to court with them to be supportive, to oppose unlawful detainer actions, supporting an unjust... should I say a just eviction ordinance, which would require landlords to actually have some basis for evicting people before they bump them out on the street. Anything else you want to say the Tenants' Rights Union of Santa Cruz is doing as a sort of an initial commercial here?
Well, we try to give support to people that are having landlord problems, as well as information and possible strategies and referrals.
So I understand that your phone number, for those who want it, and tell me if I'm wrong, is 426-0644?
Yes.
Is that still available for folks to call in if they're having tenant problems or if they want to help people with tenant problems?
Yes.
426-0644.
One of the things I wanted to say is that
sure.
A lot of people that get a 30 or 60 day notice will move out and they won't say anything. There's a man in Aptos right now that I was talking to this week in that situation. I think his landlord's getting a little demented because it's an older woman and So she wants him out and doesn't have a place to move by tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what he's going to do.
You know what might be a possible solution here?
What I've heard lately is a lot of places, there's 50 or 60 applications right now.
Right.
Yeah. For a lot of places that are available for rent.
Michael Schmidt has something he wants to say about that.
You know, when you look at leases, because I used to do a lot of lease negotiation for Bank of America, the lease, 99.9% of the time, favors the landlord enormously. And maybe we need to figure out ways to have clauses, and maybe implemented by ordinance if necessary, that would install and create this kind of due cause process that you're talking about, that would give tenants at least some comfort level that if they have a demented landlord or just a greedy one, that there would be some protection for them, or some process that was in writing in their lease that would give them the ability to get assistance or arbitrate or whatever the heck it might be, because again, most leases favor the landlord by rights, because you know they've got the property and they're maintaining it theoretically and all the rest.
What do you think, Donna? Is that something you've been advocating in terms of this? Is that related at all to the just eviction law? I guess that kind of precedes just eviction, and just signatures or just rental laws or something.
I think I've lost the thread of what you're trying to say there.
Well, he was saying that, you know, we need something in the leases that allows people more rights as they move in, maybe something that is initiated by legal change that would give tenants in the Santa Cruz County at least some kind of protections. Although, I don't know, it's really hard to buck a wild, whirlwind free market that is catering to, you know, dot-com dodos.
Well, we talked also about alternative housing and possibly mm-hmm. at UCSC getting them involved in
UCSC.
Different types of, you know, progressive housing living situations. And as possibilities, the Cosahedron.
Michael has sort of passed me this average annual growth rates that the enrollment targets that apparently Santa Cruz is trying to pump up its enrollment according to the figures he has. You know, I always thought that we need a student activist tenant coalition to kick the doodah out of the masterminds at the university that are trying to essentially seize all the housing and just engage in this cancerous university growth.
Well, you've been talking to some of the students. Did you go to the Fireside Lounge?
I went to the Fireside Lounge. Unfortunately, there were only about four or five people there, and I knew most of them before I arrived. But what about what role?
What I heard is some of them are sleeping in the woods. And,
that's,
you know,
I believe, true. That is true. I don't think any of those actually showed up, but maybe they were too busy avoiding the gendarmes or doing finals or something like that. Michael, let me ask you, and then perhaps you could comment, Donna. What's the role of the university here, and how can the city rein in this cancerous activity that's going on? How should we do? What can we do? What can the community do?
Well, I've been doing some polling and focus groups for the campaign, and the one thing I'm finding is that the growth of the university is a very hot topic, especially on the west side. The university made a commitment to the community, I think, in the 80s that they would house, 70% of their undergraduates, 50% of their graduates, and 25% of their faculty. They've been at the same 49% for their undergraduates, about 15% for their for the graduate students, and about 5% or 10% for their faculty over that last period. And yes, they continue to grow at about 500 students or more per year. Tidal Wave 2, which you can go to the Regents, UC Regents website, shows that Santa Cruz has a compounded growth rate of 4.1% between 1998 and the year 2010. Looking at a student population by 2010-2011 of 16,900. You've also got the issue of up there. There is probably going to be another 3,000 staff that supports these students, and then probably umpteen numbers of faculty. So this the university, I think, has a strategic role to play. I know the Regents has some plans in place that supposedly are going to mitigate that. But unfortunately, my concern is, and I think what I'm hearing from the constituency is, until we can figure out a way and catch up, maybe that growth rate needs to be pared back.
How do we do that?
Well,
before you answer that, Donna, can you turn down your radio slightly? I know you probably won't be able to hear Michael unless you have it on a little bit, but it's echoing a bit. That's a little better. I think that's better.
We're in a tunnel.
We seem to be in a tunnel. There better be light at the end of the tunnel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. No, that's no problem. So, but what do we do now? I mean, what's going to stop the? I mean, why should the regents pay any attention? Why even your own Chamber of Commerce, Michael? I think is kind of pro university and nervous about your speaking out on this issue. And certainly that we don't see any heroics from Tim Fitzmaurice and the City Council. What's to be done?
I think it has to be a more concerted effort. You know, poor Marcy Greenwood, she has to live with the numbers that they're giving her, that she has to operate by, and the goals they set for her.
She's the chancellor.
She's the chancellor. And the issue that needs to be taken is to the regents. A countywide issue from the Board of Supervisors, from the city councils, of the affected communities, Santa Cruz, Capitola, and especially the 3rd District and possibly even Jan Butte's district. We need to lobby and make it known to the regents the concern we have, that we have an enormous housing crisis here. We have rental units that are being, families that are being forced out, and young people that can't find a place to live that are graduating. When you look at the university, over 95% of the students that come there are from somewhere else. They're not from our community, like UCLA, for example, where 98% of the students come from the UCLA Basin, and we got from their own university data suggests that 36% of these graduates stay here in our community, and why not? This is a great place to live. So that adds enormous housing pressure. So if you got 500 students a year or more coming to the university, and as they graduate, 37% of them staying in your community, and you're not providing the housing on campus that you promised the community you would do, then I think something has to give, and that's got to be a fully focused effort, and needs to be a hue and outcry, and I think probably the political establishment has to be the leader for that. That's what we pay these people for. That's what supposedly they're elected for.
Good luck.
Yeah, I know. And this is probably going to be one of my themes as I take it forward, because in the areas that we've talked with, the focus groups and the polling data suggest that the community has kind of had it. The university is an enormous asset. They're a $900 million economic engine to this community. But there's also an Achilles heel here, and that Achilles heel is the fact that we don't have enough housing, and we're seeing families in Beach Flats. Well, I've talked with landlords that are telling me they would now prefer to rent to students because they can get the average family who sends a kid to UC is got $90,000 household income. They can pay huge deposits and they're perceived to be here illegally. So consequently, it's easier to rent to students than it is to rent to some of our Latino members and folks coming from south of the border who are doing a lot of the work here that you're doggone find the students doing.
You know, Donna, on campus yesterday, I found that students are planning to do some kind of educate the alumni, educate the parents when they all come back in the fall. And I was thought, how nice, they'll give them all flyers. And that's what a big deal 3 months down the road. But there does seem to be a kind of a growing kind of disenchantment and dissatisfaction and determination by some groups. They're talking a lot about affordable housing rather than, I heard this, oh, we don't want to deal with a sleeping ban because sleeping outside isn't good enough for the homeless, so we want to give them affordable housing. Of course, what they don't understand is if you find people sleeping outside and people get visible out there, they're much more likely to get affordable housing because it's an embarrassment to the community. But what about you, Trusk, and the students? Have students been at all involved in Trusk? Do you see much hope up there at the university? Are we getting into a more militant phase here?
It seems like it to me. I've heard of a couple of students groups organizing around the housing issue. There was a young man at the Sentinel Housing Coalition meeting I talked to, and he was involved in one of the groups up there. So I thought that was a real positive step, and hopefully we can work together on these types of problems.
Mm-hmm. And
provide some type of temporary housing, at least, for people. Can't just expect them to disappear because, landlord wants to make a lot of money.
What are the issues that you would want Michael Schmidt to deal with if he got elected supervisor? I'm not a big fan of the supervisor campaign by Schmidt, so I think he's going to be taken over by his right-wing financial buddies.
Well, you told me you're working for Marty, so...
Huh?
You told me you were going to work for Marty campaign.
Yeah,
I'm
going to start a Norse for Wormhout group in order to give Schmidt a little backhand support here. I don't know. I think Marty deserves to have me closely embracing her campaign. I'm sure she'd love that. But I don't. I think, the supervisor, political institutions as they're currently constituted are just not responsive to the community, even when decent people like Michael are there. I think he's going to find his energies subverted and he'd be extremely frustrated. And you know, problems like that. But what would you want him to put forward? If he was on the Board of Supervisors today, what changes would you like him to make?
Well, we talked about some of the ideas, as, you know, far as enacting some type of rent board, definitely that, and registering landlords and, you know, people, definitely disabled people and seniors having their rent within the CPI index and have some kind of cap on the rents, alternative housing, and, you know, stop punishing people for becoming homeless or people that are already homeless. And, you know, we can't keep having people die on the streets because there's a lack of housing. It's just not fair. And
it's so messy, too. All these corpses, you know. It's kind of untidy and it tends to odoriferous. But go ahead.
Could be
absolutely
a public health issue.
Undemocratic, and I don't see how people can live with it. And as far as the legislators, they say they want to see the real political will of the people. So I encourage people to contact all those agencies and, you know, make their voice be heard.
Well, I, of course, encourage them to do the same, and I would, I mean, we've seen the problem with Mayor Tim, I'm a Green Party man, but don't ask me about the sleeping ban, Fitzmaurice, who actually testified in court yesterday. He was, you know, he's actually pushing this injunction, which makes it illegal for three of us to even be at the city council offices to peacefully lobby for a change in the sleeping ban. And of course, he has no intention of putting any kind of change in the law or rent control on the city council agenda. He's blocked that for 5 months, and whenever you ask him, he says, oh, rent control, if we talk about that, the landlords will all raise their rents. You know, that's his response. Brilliant.
Well, they've
brilliant.
Already been doing it, as Bob and Monica, I'm sure, has.
Oh, I don't think the argument merits any kind of rational response. I think it is a preposterous argument. Sure, they'll raise the rents. They'll raise the rents anyway, as you point. Control. If we talk about that, the landlords will all raise their rents. You know, that's his response. Brilliant.
Well, they've
brilliant.
Already been doing it, as Bob and Monica, I'm sure, has.
Oh, I don't think the argument merits any kind of rational response. I think it is a preposterous argument. Sure, they'll raise the rents. They'll raise the rents anyway, as you point out. It's a non-responsive argument. But the problem with Fitzmaurice is he's unaccountable, and his Green Party buddies will not hold him accountable either. They actually met with him and talked to him in the last month in a secret meeting in his chambers because, you know, there was supposed to be a homeless working group, open Green Party process, where Green Party members who are members of the homeless working group can go, you know, be a part of that. We were, myself and Becky Johnson, and I suppose a few others, were excluded and not notified about this situation. And they also met on territory that had I walked into his office, I would have been arrested because I'm barred from that area. So it's, you know, and Fitzmaurice isn't doing anything about the sleeping ban issue, the rent control issue, and he's saying is, oh, well, do a lot more lobbying, and then maybe we'll do something. You know, I mean.
Well, you know, there's another group here that's very and historically been very politically powerful. Mm-hmm. SCAN. I think it's interesting.
I call them scum, actually.
Well, yeah. SCAN, I sometimes call them. But, mm-hmm. you know, here they are. I read that they're having a fundraiser to try to get back the tidelands.
Oh, right.
Real
coming
high priority
sixth,
issue for our community. But taking on issues that would help students, help seniors, help families, even help some of their own members, provide housing. Now, a splinter group has spun off and has formed the Santa Cruz Housing Land Trust, which is one that I was involved with, a similar operation in New Mexico. A great idea. This is
great
important.
Idea.
But not for a very large number of people. That's
no, it's
going to
be,
teeny tiny, you know.
Especially at this point in time, if this had happened 15 years ago, we wouldn't probably be having as much of this discussion as we're having today. But as I talked to Donna, I said the big concern at the county level is that they've got to stop downsizing properties. I mean, we've got properties that could have 40 units per whatever, and they're downsizing it to 9 or 10. And we wonder why we have a housing crisis, because we have the county has 65% of the land that they control. We need to, and they also own a ton of land, that the acres and acres of land that the county controls that could be available. That's close
to
transit.
What about this wild growth Schmidt? What do you think of this, Donna? Is this another one of these? Is he a real estate agent trying to sneak into office here? What's going on? I mean, there are some people who.
He sounds pretty logical. At least he's willing to talk about a lot of these things, which some of our politicians have basically ignored.
No, not only would they, won't they talk about it, they'll arrest you if you try to talk about it. It's a rather uncomfortable situation.
Well, you get to go to court.
Dear.
Look at it that way.
You did get to go to court, yeah. I guess, what about, what kind of commitments would you like Mr. Schmidt to make here publicly on the air in the face of all his, as we watch his financial supporters run in terror after hearing this broadcast, that he will, do you want him to commit himself to a just eviction law if he's a board of supervisors? Within 1 month, he will bring up a just eviction law. Would you like to hear him say that on the air here today?
Sure.
You going to say that on the air today?
Well, let me see if I can go this far.
Uh-oh, here we go. The equivocating begins.
No, I think you're on the right track. Well, I would like to see some way where we could bring the parties together, folks like your group, Donna, and the real estate associations, to sit down and see what kind of a just eviction law can be written that is, one, enforceable, two, that is equitable to both parties, and three, will get us the results that we want. To just have someone like me who is not terribly in depth on this issue to sit down and say, well, I want to work with county council and write some just eviction law, may end up making a bigger problem than what we want and not solving the problem. I'd like to figure out a way. I'm a big on collaboration, and I believe that sitting the people down in a room, as we did with Vision Santa Cruz to rebuild our community, can help us come up with that just eviction process, or they may come up with an idea on their own to say, here's the way we think we can do it through some incentive issues, if you'll cooperate, that we'll work within our associations to make happen. I mean, but
or
I
Or they could just adopt the EEPO that we have on our website.
That could be true,
too. Which is kind of a model of different California cities that do have some kind of rent stabilization.
Now, what is your website for those who would like to go to that and read
those? It's at cruisers.com/tenants' rights.
One more time.
cruisers.com/tenants' rights/tilde,
that's that little kind of squiggle.
Okay.
Tenants' rights. So
yeah.
Again, one more time.
cruisers.com/tenants' rights.
Gotcha. So
so I hope to hear more tenants on the email.
Yeah, definitely.
To check out, what's on there as far as a basic model. At least they have something, and it seems like you, Michael, know more about, say, New Jersey and other parts of the country also that have some type of rent stabilization as well, and it sounds, like that could be an important
part. What do the two of you think about the Jennifer Brager controversy? She's the woman who put out the article by Gordon Pusser, raising money among landlords in anticipation of a rent control drive by city council, which doesn't exist. I would be nice if it did. She wrote a letter in yesterday's Metro denouncing that idea and suggesting that perhaps it was being spread by people like Robert Norris and Becky Johnson and Bob LaMonica, those three evil geniuses of rent control in the Santa Cruz community. Any comments by either of you on that? On Jennifer Brager in the article.
Let me quote from her letter.
Mm-hmm.
Let's JB Associates would like to work with local property owners to monitor the situation locally and coordinate a long-term strategy to ensure that rent control is not passed in the city of Santa Cruz. I think that sentence says it all.
And would you favor that, oppose that? What's your sense on that, Michael?
Again, I think it pits one group against the other. We don't accomplish anything. If we can sit down at the table, collaborate, reasonable people, I believe, can come up with reasonable solutions that will work. And I think we'll get more of that way, because even in the Jersey study showed that on the good news was you did control the rate of rent increase. I think it averaged out to be $27 per year per unit.
Mm-hmm.
The bad news was that you ended up with fewer rental units, you didn't have an impact on new construction, and you ended up with more units in dilapidated conditions. So we got enough units here in dilapidated conditions without adding more to it.
And what do you say about those concerns, Donna, that, you get a breaking on the rents, but you also get less units being built and more units dilapidating?
No, you don't get more units. You get the same number of units being built. You tend to lose units overall.
Because
landlords get frustrated with the process, and most of the time it's probably too bureaucratical, and so they sell their units, which is what happened to us in the 80s in this city. We had a lot of private property landlords who just got tired of it and sold off their units to private homeowners, and we lost those rental units.
And what do you think about this, Donna? Is this a good argument?
Mike Rodkin seemed to think that, some landlords probably would get out of the business because it's not profitable enough for them.
What do you think?
And others would come in.
Others would come in.
I think it's a guaranteed income. I mean, they're getting huge equity on the housing.
Yep.
Even if they're paying a high mortgage on it, they're getting a huge tax break from the equity on the housing.
Mm-hmm.
And, they're making out a lot better. With a lot of tenants, a lot of them are baby boomers now, with no prospects for owning a home, which is another issue, is having a real first-time buyers program for county residents.
Mm-hmm. So let's have you hammer down some commitments from Schmidt here. How about an agreement to meet within 2 months to get you and the realtors and whatever hacks from the city want to come in to get together a proposal so that within 3 months there'll be something on the boards as a specific proposal that can go around the community and get community support. Would you two be up for that?
I would be
sure.
Up for that.
So anybody who wants to join this process could contact you, Donna, at 426-0644. And you, Michael, can you give a number where you can be reached for this potential, what do you want to call it, stop rent profiteering or renter protection? How renter protection? That's a nice, safe-sounding phrase, isn't it?
Well, I don't think greed should really be so much of a virtue.
Well, don't get Christian on me here, Donna. I mean, come on, this is America, for heaven's sake. So what's a number that, Michael, that you can, if people want to join this renter protection forum that you are now going to sponsor?
Well, let's keep in mind that the primary isn't until March of 2002 and the general election isn't until November, so...
I'm not concerned about that at all. I'm concerned about getting, that you as an activist, I think, can do far more than you as a supervisorial candidate.
Hold it, your question was, within 90 days after electing office, would I do this?
Right, no.
Oh.
I'm talking about now, getting together with Donna in the next few months to initiate this process, regardless of whether you get
elected.
Well,
I think in part, we're already doing that through the Housing Coalition effort that we're putting, because rent control and the whole issue of the escalating rents has got to be on the table as we look at this.
Yeah, it's been great. All the big wigs have been there.
Yeah, and when is the next such meeting that people can know about? Because it isn't really widely known, this process. I guess the Sentinel is running it.
Well, they're trying to, I give them high marks for this. This is one of the examples where the Sentinel has stepped up to the plate. And let's see here if I have a date when that next one's going to be.
Michael is looking through his busy schedule here. You don't happen to know the date of it, Donna?
I think it's going to be on June the 22nd.
June the 22nd. Where will that be? At what time?
My guess is we may have it at the Cessnon House, but I have not been given a specific location.
And the phone number of people to call, Michael, should they wish to harass you on this issue, is?
Probably call my home phone number at 469-4382.
469-4382.
Yeah.
So you don't want the Chamber of Commerce involved?
I don't think the Chamber would get terribly excited about this right now.
About renter protections, yeah. See, here's a man who's giving away his home phone number. That says to me a great deal, because when David Silva calls him at 2 in the morning, it's going to be an interesting conversation. No, just kidding, David. No big deal. Actually, I'm referring to we did a call-in, some of us did, at the city council level. I wasn't one of them, but some people I knew did. Reminding city council members, even in the wee hours of the morning, that while they were slumbering peacefully, other people were getting rousted by the police. That, of course, did not earn a lot of plaudits in some quarters, but in others, people nodded sagely and said, serves them right. So,
Robert, Donna, I'm going to have to get out of here.
Schmidt is making a getaway, but...
Again, I think we should try to meet face to face and just sit down and.
Do you two want to declare a time for a meeting in the next week or two, which we can invite other people to come to here on the air?
I think what I'd like to do.
The famed Baker Square might be the place to come.
Okay, Robert, that's fine with me.
Okay.
When is that, on Thursday morning?
Let's see. We can't make it the Monday morning group because I would be excluded, and that would be a no-no.
Okay.
Of course, if Christopher Crown tells Michael to exclude me from this group, I don't know what's going to happen. I mean, we'll see. You.
Christopher Crown.
Or is it Ed Porter who doesn't like me?
Oh,
yeah. Landscape Ed.
Oh, boy.
The man with the urban forest.
Yes.
The 7th, how's the 7th of June look?
7th of June, how's that look for you, Donna? What is that? What day is that?
That's a Thursday.
That sounds fine.
And what time of day?
You want to do 8 o'clock in the morning?
Can you do 8 a.m.? Is that too early?
That's fine.
Okay. And where are we going to meet at Baker?
You want to make it the infamous Baker's Square?
Okay.
And we want to let all the audience know that if you come, Robert's buying breakfast.
I will certainly be buying breakfast, but I'll be leaving before the bill gets paid. So sort of bye-bye to breakfast. That's what he's really saying here.
Okay.
I'll buy coffee if anybody is so impoverished as to be unable to purchase a cup of coffee. Other than that, you're on your own. Now, again, that's June 7th, Thursday, Baker Square, which is a restaurant on Ocean Street, for those of you who don't know, between Denny's and...
right next to the CVC, by the way.
It's right next to that cheesy little CVC convention center that doesn't let homeless people in, as I remember at their opening. Boy, what a group of NIMBY crumbs. But perhaps your talk will be able to enlighten them in this situation. Mr. Schmidt, you never can tell, and maybe it was just a fluke. Maybe it was my bad breath that persuaded them otherwise.
That bathrobe and the teddy bear.
The bathrobe and the teddy bear were not in evidence at the time. But if you want to see those, you can come to court tomorrow at 3 o'clock when we'll be resuming the coffee klatch evidentiary trial. So again, if you want to, Baker Square, June 7th, for the renter protection discussions between Schmidt and Dice. You'll see the two clashing or perhaps embracing. Who knows?
Well, you just love controversy.
You bet.
If he doesn't love it, he tries to create it.
I know.
Certainly. A vicious slander, which I reject. Thank you, Michael, for being with us. And Donna, thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And yes, that was... thank you very much, Michael. He's leaving the studio now, leaving me all alone with the mic and with you out there. And the phone lines are open for you to call in, 427-3772. Again, if you had questions that you weren't able to deal with, you will... Or actually, you can call him at his home phone. I mean, he's quite an accessible guy.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, well, I wish I'd gotten to give props to Michael, because I really think for a candidate, much less any politician, to be speaking so frankly about such issues is very impressive.
Oh, well, I think we can pass that on to him. Yeah, he's impressed me repeatedly in the last year for his willingness to not budge in the face of pressure from existing political figures, even people that he's employed by. He's simply said, look, I have my views, and I'm going to say them, and I find that rare.
Freaking
rare.
Killer. No, that is.
Yeah.
It's a rare thing, like I said, especially for a politician.
Oh, yeah.
Much less just for any...
Well, I don't think Schmidt is really a politician. I think that, you know, for a politician, it's
aspiring,
rare.
Aspiring.
Right. I'm not too happy with his idea of running for supervisor, because I think it's going to deplete and dilute his activism. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe through some miracle, he'll be able to maintain his purity throughout this process. I really, really doubt it. But, you know, Schmidt surprised me before.
We need those strong attempts either way.
That's for sure. Is there more? Is there specific stuff you wanted to talk about? You're welcome to, even though he's not here. Are there
I think it's. I'm really. Past couple days, like I guess you mentioned. I don't know what you said, but you said you saw something on campus yesterday.
I went up to campus to do a showing of Campground and also the Ken Mashish Berkeley Sleeping Band fight films that. Unfortunately,
that's
couldn't...
That's right, the Porter thing.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah.
And there was, of course, a thing tonight, which actually just began 10 minutes ago, to serve and protect at Kresge Town Hall. I'm sorry, it starts at 7:30, so you can still get there if you want to hustle on over there. And it's not... probably a little late, but to serve and protect is a video about police brutality in Santa Cruz, and it is on... It has been remastered and... Any other comments other than your fine reassurance there?
Oh, not too much. I don't know anything more going on. I was having a good time listening to Mr. Schmidt. He really will make a good candidate. He goes to a lot of meetings, like, you know, you were speaking, mm-hmm. and he works with at the meetings, goes to them, works hard at the meetings with anyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't just go for coffee and donuts and steak dinners and
the parade,
you know, no, he not at the what do you call it, the golf club and the what do you call it, anyway, special places, you know, that no one gets to go. But he works real hard. He was at Texas Instrument fighting for the homeless, you know, with us there to be able to park in the area. I know he was in working a lot on that.
By the way, I've
safe zones.
I got a report from activist Jerry Henry yesterday about a man being beaten downtown recently. Number of apparently violent incidents along Pacific Avenue. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, there have been a couple. Oh, about 3 weeks ago or so, I have heard of a couple of things, and I'm not real sure if I know one of them. I'm not real sure. I hate to say it over the phone, but I think one of them might have been Billy, you know, Billy, what do you call him?
Berkeley Billy?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
The name that they gave me, that I heard given.
I think I heard something similar. I'm not quite sure. I've kind of been a little disorganized in the last couple of weeks as far as keeping my notes together, so I'm not on top of this, as you can see, and I do appreciate, by the way, you're taping the show.
And also, there's another thing for veterans. I don't know if anyone's on the...
Tell me.
And I hope it's still going. What days are they doing the veterans? Yeah, Wednesdays and Thursday mornings, they were serving breakfast. But a lot of people can go. It's at Veterans Hall.
What time?
At 8 o'clock is when it starts. They serve breakfast, and then they have a lunch also.
That's Wednesday. The Veterans Hall at the top of the mall, right across
right.
from
that's
the 10
eggs,
o'clock.
That's eggs, sausage, you know.
Next to the post office.
Bacon, eggs.
Wednesday morning,
whatever.
8 o'clock for veterans. And, you know, whip out your old
You can be homeless,
uniform.
Too. I think it's for everyone, but I'm not sure. It's at the Veterans Hall, and it may kind of be veteran-specific if it really gets, but I don't think anyone really asks.
Well, I want to remind you there is a meeting today of, I guess the ACLU is running at a Loudoun Nelson Center on members of the Death Penalty Speak Out. And for some people, homelessness is a death sentence, you know, and given the kind of pressures that people are under. We see this, you know, in terms of the casualties each year. And I think I've been trying to get the ACLU to get off its, paunchy liberal butt and do something about the sleeping ban locally for a long time. And it's, of course, not possible. Bob Tarrant is...
Well, he didn't do anything.
Doesn't seem to be able to do nothing, you know.
He's kind of like absurd. I don't know what he is. He's like some satellite out there that, you know, is pointing the wrong direction.
Similarly with, you know, other people who are, you know, who are members of the organization. Apparently, that's sort of like, you know, getting on the homeless... I don't know. I don't want to say the Homeless Issues Task Force, because I actually found that the people on the Homeless Issues Task Force did do a lot of work and did try to get proposals forward, and then, of course, the problem was they never carried it beyond the
discussion
stage.
Well, you know, gave all the information to City Council, and City Council just like, you know...
Right, City Council
okay.
did its expected, you
just
know,
like,
oh, that's
you know,
nice, next issue.
In one ear, out the other. I don't
right.
even know...
I'm still waiting for Linda LaMaster to throw her damn press conference, you know, on this issue that actually would have members, former members of the Homeless Issues Task Force saying, it's a year later, we're coming together today because we see the City Council hasn't done anything. We want to present again these important issues. But, you know, they can't... I remember talking about this, how Brindell, who continues to disappoint me, Paul Brindell of the Community Action Board Shelter Project... You know,
sure, he's another one, though, when it comes down to the end of it. You know, he talks good and everything.
Yeah,
when it comes down to the end, he does the same thing everyone else does.
His strong voice was able to stop the people midterm from in December demanding, having a press conference and demanding that City Council take action to suspend the sleeping ban over the winter of 1999-2000. And what his argument was, oh, we need a press conference later when we can do it much more effectively. And of course, he never organized such a press conference later. That never happened. Brindell was the only vote against the coffee clatch when we were at the California Homeless Civil Rights Organizing Project meeting a month or two ago. On the phone, he voted against supporting the coffee clatch 3.
Well, when the county gave that BS report just prior to the homeless, you know, report, that was such a bullshit lie, you know, of the content of what they say they do for the homeless and what they do with that money.
What report are we talking about?
You know, when the county. Our report sounds like that there are is
the Monday morning group meeting. That's Schmidt's group, and I'm one of the organizers.
Much as they can right now, but they're just severely inundated with people.
Really? Is that the story?
And, right. And I guess this will be an all right radio station to say it on. There is a kind of a parking zone going on around there and Costco. And
I've heard something about that.
And
kind of a de facto safe zone.
Right. That. You know, that may be okay or not. You know, they'll probably check you out. Officer Seeley will probably check you out.
How is Seeley doing? Is he better than we thought?
I think he's doing much better. I think he's received an education.
Very good. Well, I mean, Seeley is
heavy. Yeah, I'd say it almost, because I was really perturbed with him because of, you know, a particular thing that Karen Gillette tried to get
well,
him to
Well, he
do.
Was her little thug, her enforcement
yeah.
agent, but that was some years ago, and he may have mellowed since then, you know.
Well, you know, I'm sure he didn't know what she was doing was unlawful. Mm-hmm. Anyway.
Well, I just noticed downtown, the police are still, they're still harassed, as you may have heard, if you heard the last show, Steve Elliott, the rock man who was, doing his rock sculptures, and he had a sign that said disabled, looking for change, and Sergeant Baker told him that was a false claim and a violation of the panhandling ordinance the Scott Kennedy passed in 1994. And he was of course full of shit. Even if he had been saying I'm disabled aloud to people, that, and he was lying about it, that would have been a violation of Kennedy's infamous law. But you can say anything you want on a sign, and we found that by examining the text of the law a day later. So Baker, as usual, has not got a very good grasp of the law in this community, and seems to have this anti-homeless bias in which he simply enforces his own prejudices. We saw this with Jen Curry when he reportedly, by her account, smashed her into a vehicle for going the wrong way on Pacific Avenue on January 19th. And if there's anybody out there, by the way, who saw that incident, give a call to 423-HUFF, even if you did before, 423-4833. She is going to court, and she needs your help.
It's people like him also that, you know, he's on the board of directors of the HCRC.
That is what makes them such a joke.
And, it's absurd, you know, Catherine Byers being on the board, too.
We're talking about the Homeless Services Center Board.
And Donna, whatchamacallit?
Donna...
Murillo.
Murillo, downtown,
yeah,
merchant stuff.
And some of the most absurd people.
Oh, because the Homeless Services...
They go wash themselves, you know, and,
well, remember that the homeless
dip themselves in antiseptic after a meeting at,
right,
the homeless.
Well, they don't have homeless people in those meetings. I mean, the woman who was supposed to be the homeless representative, Mama Joy, hasn't been seen in many a moon, as far as I know.
Yeah, she's... I'm not real sure what's up with her.
I mean, it's not...
I think she was going to Hawaii, maybe.
I mean, what this whole thing is, Linda Edwards called it way back in 1993 or 4. This is the Homeless Containment Center. This is where homeless people are supposed to go off to be, so they aren't downtown.
And the ruling elite, you know, are in control of
it is sort of a concentration camp in the sense that it is where people, if you don't go there, you're at a higher pressure to be criminalized, and if you do go there, then you get a little relief during the day.
The lack of integrity in all of this, all the political going on in this county is really bad. And you know, I just hope Mike can keep his integrity. I'm sure he can. I'm sure he can. I just don't see how he could lose it. He just keeps going, as far as I know.
He seems to.
He just may run into a lot of people without integrity and not get anywhere, you know, when you're outnumbered so much.
Yes. Well, listen, Doug, I thank you for calling. Is there more you want to say? I'm going to roll.
No, go ahead. Go ahead, and I'll open it up. I was going to tell you I got it rolling for you.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that was old-time activist, formerly homeless member, and Homeless Issues Task Force stalwart, although he wasn't officially on the task force. He was the partner to the woman who was, Marilyn Weaver. Doug McGrath. And thank you, Doug, for calling in. And phone lines are now open at 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. We have another half hour to go, and hopefully that half hour will actually be committed to tape, not that it'll ever be played again, but it's always nice to have a copy of this just in case somebody wants to hear it. We do a show twice a week here, we being me, myself, and I. Every Sunday from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon, every Thursday from 6 to 8. I don't know how much longer these shows are going to be continuing, but as long as we can, we're going to be doing them, and we'll be hearing from you too, we hope. And I encourage you to, you know, do call in, because what you have to say is important. And I'm pretty glib, but I've only got one point of view here.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, so how much are you going to pay your producer?
Well, we're thinking of paying in donuts and hugs. That's the... So why, do you want the job?
I'm an aspiring producer, and I have nothing to do.
Oh, wow. Hey, you and me better get together.
Well.
That's great.
Hey, I wanted to say, when Schmidt was on,
yes,
and he brought that up, one of the things I wanted to tell him, and hopefully, is that, I mean, there's been so many times when I've been renting, I've rented different places, finally I'm stable now because of, have a landlord that isn't greedy, which is so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
But
wow. What are you paying?
Usually, I'm always thinking, oh, if I could just get a copy of tenant's rights to this person. And a lot of people in Santa Cruz are subletting. Mm-hmm. They don't pay the landlord; they pay the person that's paying the rent.
Right.
And that's even worse because then it's all fuzzy. And so many people are going through psychic abuse from having to take crap, because if they don't, they'll be booted out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another issue that hasn't been brought up, because how can we even deal with that until we deal with the substantial physical realities of everything? So
I
wanted to say that I would support him totally. That's the thing that needs to be done, is that landlords need to be registered. I mean, why shouldn't... I mean, it's not that they're being registered. They should know the laws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just the way... It's like so logical, and this occurred to me about 4 years ago, so I'm so glad to hear him say that.
Mm-hmm. So you're a renter yourself these days.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I live in my own...
vehicle?
Dwelling.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
But it's... No, I mean, well...
Your own shack on the edge of town.
No, I bought a trailer, a 14-foot trailer, and I found a place to put it.
Oh, that's
which
great.
Which is, of course, illegal, because we're not supposed to be in a backyard.
Uh-oh.
But, you know, nobody's going to do anything about it, really. I mean, as long as I don't have wild parties and keep the neighbors up and...
And don't produce the wrong radio shows.
Okay, so anyway, I found this thing in town. I wanted to call you up because I don't know who's putting this out, but I picked up this petition. It says, petition for voter-approved rent control and reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Landlords have been revolting against the Constitution and the Bill of Rights since 1776.
Mm-hmm.
They block non-property owners' right to fair trade housing by giving themselves credit for your monthly housing payments and labor. What to do? Join Renter Revolt and help in whatever way you can to freeze and roll back local rents. And then it says, automatic membership in California Tenants Union with benefits. And then it doesn't have a phone number. It has a web page. Have you ever heard of these people? I wanted to read something, another part of it.
What's the web page?
It's tenant.congress@usa.net.
Sounds like Billy Cayley, who's also a tenant activist around. He's not all the time in town, but he has been active on the issue for a long time, particularly rent control. He wants to see rent strikes and so forth.
There's a sentence here. It says, we'd already have rent control if we knew that 1,000 student signatures would be disqualified for changing dorms, even if they maintain the same mailing address. Join us in putting this measure on the ballot for Santa Cruz County, and it says Corlitas watches also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I didn't know about that, but that does make, that sounds like a little tactic there to...
Yeah, I think a broad variety of, initiatives from different quarters is always good, and remind people that on June 7th at 8 a.m. at Baker's Square, Schmidt and Donna Dice will be there to sign you up to do work to start the new renter protection movement. That's what my hope is, a fantasy person that I am, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have it marked. I don't know. I have it marked on my calendar.
You better.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And those phone lines, once again, I should say that phone line is open. So give us a call, 427-3772, 427-3772. Here's a quick update on the City Council Coffee Clatch. I should say, well, there is no City Council Coffee Clatch and Tag Team Teach-In. That went on between the December 4th through December 27th or 28th. It continued a day after Becky Johnson, Bernard Klitzner, and myself, Robert Norris, got enjoined, served with the TRO for allegedly harassing Mayor Tim Fitzmaurice's administrative aide, Anna Brooks, and that case is currently in trial now, or I should say evidentiary hearing, before Judge Samuel Stevens, Department 7, and it will resume on Friday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Come on down. You missed Tim Fitzmaurice equivocating, sort of smiling and snarling on the stand. He's quite a figure up there, but you won't miss the star of the show. Me, I'll be giving. I'm certainly not one. I'm just one of the stars of the show. But I'll be giving my. I'll be confronting the city attorney. He'll be cross-examining me. That begins again 3 o'clock on June 1st tomorrow, at Department 7, Samuel Stevens Court, on Friday. But now the coffee clutch has ended because people didn't carry it on. And one of the reasons they didn't carry it on was because they had essentially criminalized the leaders. And that's why this is such a deliberate, arrogant, just blatant political suppression. Anna Brooks was never the target of anything we were doing. I mean, she was there and she had to deal with two or three people sitting in her office, or one or two, depending on the time. But, you know, I mean, and she would have preferred that we weren't there, and apparently it was hitting her pretty hard at a certain point. But, you know, all we knew was that she was sort of an obstreperous individual at times. At other times she was, you know, fair, not fair, she was, you know, what you would expect of a person running an office. Officious. in many senses of the word, which you could have seen had you seen Anna Brooks testifying on the stand. She was, well, she had a very very different perception of events than we did. She felt we were intentionally staring at her while she was doing phone calls, intentionally overhearing her phone calls. You couldn't help but overhear anything, everything in that area, and we weren't staring at her. I mean, there were confrontational moments between Anna Brooks and the protesters, largely because of her kind of controlling attitude, and rather, she had a tendency to talk to you as though you were a six-year-old with a hearing defect if she didn't like your response or she was, you know, having a problem with you. And, you know, it's just her style. And her style was a little offensive to me at different times, but, you know, people have a different style. My main interest was in getting Fitzmaurice and the city council to deal with the issue of the sleeping ban over the winter, and I would like to now see them deal with it over the summer, because, you know, here we are in the summer, and though the weather has gotten warmer, the number of illegal shelter spaces has gotten less. And while it's good to hear that you know, there is some decriminalization going on kind of behind the scenes, which is what the last caller talked about, it's not very secure, because it means at any time it can be swept away from people. And I don't think that is, it's like an underground economy or a shadow economy or a black market. I mean, you know, it's nice to have if you have access to it, but, you know, people who are really vulnerable have to be very afraid of using it, because, you know, they can get swept aside, they can get arrested, they can get hurt, they can suffer accidents or injuries there. You need something that is legal and above boards. It's like all these illegal units. You know, you got to decriminalize the accessory dwelling units. You got to put some real kind of renter protection, rent control in place. You've got to deal with issues that the city council has been absolutely unwilling to deal with, and not just, you know, because Ed Porter cannot wait for Marty Wormhout to give him the okay. I'm sorry, Ed, you have to be your own person here and get your shit together and, you know, move forward on this issue. You're a Green Party-endorsed candidate. You made commitments before you got into office, and you have not been keeping those commitments. Now, I got an email from David Silva talking about apparently a proposed change in the sleeping ban. This is Porter's secret plan to end the sleeping ban, which we've all been wondering about. Even Michael Schmidt can't seem to get return calls from Ed Porter, the great liberal council member who, he lost my trust long ago when he committed himself to returning calls in November, and then, you know, week after week, month after month, didn't do it. When I confronted him, he'd give me this tight smile and say, well, you talked against me on the radio, and I didn't like that, so I didn't feel I had to return your calls. You were disrespectful. Well, politicians, I'm afraid, have a responsibility to be able to weather uncomfortable criticism publicly. That is part of the game there, Ed. And if you don't like it, you shouldn't have run for office. And in fact, I think we all wish you hadn't at this point, or at least those of us who are concerned with the issues I'm concerned with. And I really would like to see some of these politicians, who I really regard as largely gutless, call in and talk about issues that concern people locally, instead of hiding behind their people like Anna Brooks and the administrative staff and the procedures of the city council and things like the courts, because the politicians are really hiding behind the courts. I mean, people are now somewhat intimidated from addressing city council members in any lobbying effort. At least I talked to one woman who was. She said she's not going to city council offices to agitate because she might get enjoined. But the fact of the matter is, you can still do so legally. There are only three people in this county, three people in this state, three people in this country who cannot go to the city council offices: me, Becky Johnson, and Bernard Klitzner. So I suggest you should go with the sign that says Robert Norris on it. I'm here because I think he should be allowed to be here. And since he's not here, I'm going to be here. And sit down, read a book, and have a sign that says end the sleeping ban. You know, don't cause any trouble. Just leave a note for the mayor or the council saying, I want to talk to you about this issue. It's time you did something about it. It's time you put the issue on the agenda. Because that is the essence of democracy. That is the essence of representative government. Or these people are not your representatives. Now, of course, they aren't. So it's a joke to begin with. But, you know, we are trying to activate democracy, to bring it back, and to actually get them to address human rights issues. Of course, it's going to be the community that addresses these issues, not these politicians. But it's still useful, I think, to proceed and to try to hold them accountable. Hey, come on down to the courts on Friday, tomorrow, and see how this thing turns out. I was rather... Well, I still think we're pretty much bound to lose this case, not because we're wrong. We're not. We're right. The city has Anna Brooks's personal concerns about feeling harassed because we may have inadvertently taken a pen or two and then offered to replace it. She has a number of charges she's put forward, which we've really gone into one after another. Oh, she feels that we are mocking her, and we are criticizing her, we are making her job impossible. But in fact, 95% of the time, we're sitting in the office quietly. The rest of the time, we did get into dialogues with city council members that came through, but that's the nature of the democratic process. I mean, it's, you know, that's how it is, particularly with city council members who are not being responsive to the democratic process. But at no time did Ms. Brooks, and this is what came out in the testimony and did not come out in the Sentinel article, which came out today for those of you who read it, at no time did Ms. Brooks or her superior, Suzanne Haberman, or her superior, Martine Bernal, the assistant city manager, or his superior, Dick, manager for life, Wilson, ever come to us and say, look, Anna Brooks is really under a lot of pressure here, she's got some problems, can you address issues A, B, and C? You know, can you be more quiet, perhaps? Can you, one of you, wait outside for a while? Can you give her a break on Tuesday? No specific concerns were ever brought to our attention. They expected us to be psychic on these issues until Anna Brooks simply went and got an injunction against us, with the full connivance and assistance of the city manager, I don't know about the city manager, but the city attorney, John Barisoni, city police force, as headed by our favorite Sergeant Butchie Baker, who came and took pictures. And when I attempted to get him to, I'll get into that in a moment. But the point is, Brooks didn't bring her concerns forward in a way that could have been dealt with. And that's, you know, I'm not trying to just criticize Anna. I mean, Anna, you know, I think she's a fragile person, and, you know, she has her limits, and she's trying to deal with the situation perhaps as best she could. But her managers, her bosses, the people around her saw what was going on. They knew her better than we did. They should have known she was really experiencing some real problems. But they chose instead to use her, or to at least to ignore the situation, until she had nothing to do but to make this a huge public issue by getting an injunction against us, in which she must have known would be a huge political deal, which would subject her to still more pressure, ironically, you know, and have to go to court, and have to face a lot of, you know, questions in the media. This is not the way to deal with a person who is as fragile as I believe she is. Now, I got to tell you, you know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for Anna Brooks in other ways. I don't like her personally a lot, you know. I don't feel she's not my kind of person particularly. But, you know, as a human being and as a worker in that office, she has the right to decent working conditions. And if those conditions were becoming onerous for her, her union, her managers should all have been involved and informed. The city attorney, the city manager, the mayor. These people came through the office occasionally. They talked to her. And for them, for example, to immediately jump on the bandwagon of her getting an injunction smacks of a kind of political favoritism, you know? What they want, a political opportunism is the word I'm looking for, instead of dealing with the real concerns in a way that would help out her and also keep the First Amendment in place, respect the rights of the public to come and use that office in terms of lobbying the city council members as it has a right to be used for. That's, you know, that's the place where you meet city council members. So, you know, it's the center of the city government. I'm sorry. You know, if a person is finding it offensive to have homeless advocates there, if it's becoming wearisome and difficult for her, she needs a break. She needs a vacation. She needs perhaps, you know, some regulations put in place that would be of assistance to her, some other people helping her. But we don't need to suspend the First Amendment under these circumstances. And I don't, again, I get a little cranky because I've been subjected to 5 months of being banned from City Hall, and I don't like it. I mean, I've been allowed to go to scheduled meetings. I've been allowed to go to other offices on official business, but I have to do so under the shadow and the fear that if I stop and talk to a homeless person who wants to be interviewed, I risk a contempt of court citation. And I'll tell you, I know what contempt of court means. I've been to jail for contempt of court in San Francisco, and that was because I served people free food with food not bombs in violation of a restraining order. I spent 27 days in jail for violating that order, and it was not a bad time in the sense that it had a good effect, but it's not something that you, I think, would want to do.
Hey, you're on free radio. Hello?
Oh, hi. This is me again, Judith.
Yeah.
Okay, well, you know, you fell from grace. You're only the second most annoying person in Santa Cruz this year, so that's good. I mean, if you were number one, they could use that against you.
Well, I resent that. You know, I mean, Bruce Bratton, he's the most feeble character you've ever, considered. It's only now, after, like, what, 2 years in the Metro, that he dares to criticize the city council. He finally lost patience with them because they rubber-stamped Rittenhouse's development downtown. Well, Bruce, what, have you been asleep for 5 years? What is your problem, you know? Give me a break.
Okay, well, so I wanted to ask you, what was Tim Fitzmaurice's testimony like, and who is, you guys have an attorney, or?
Oh, well, the city attorney was his attorney. I mean, he was...
So how did he appear? I mean, did he lie on the stand at all, or...
He made some statements that were false. I don't think he was intentionally lying. I think he miscalculated some dates. One of the reasons we were there was to get a meeting with him and to get meetings with city council members. He claimed he'd already met with us at the time of the city council coffee clatch, and therefore we were just harassing everybody around and frustrated, taking out our frustrations on Anna Brooks and other people in the vicinity, because he was saying, you are, you know, being rude and disruptive, and I won't meet with you until you leave this office and stop harassing the staff. And I mean, it's kind of a circular argument, but that was the argument he was making. And we pointed out to him, no, we didn't meet with you at all during that period. We kept asking to meet with you. You kept refusing. Other individuals who came in and got immediate meetings, but you would not meet with us on these issues. We also offered to meet with him on issues about, you know, whether there was a problem around the office, whether our behavior was causing a problem, and to work with that. He wouldn't meet with us on that issue.
Really?
He wouldn't meet with us on any issue. Now, he did lie, if you want to say it's a lie. He has a different perception of things. He would meet with us in the sense that he would walk into the office and say, I want you to leave. And we would say, you know, Tim, take your Gestapo tactics down the road. This is supposed to be, you know, the United States, where there's a constitution. You'll go order people to leave your own house, go order people to leave if you're in the military, but don't order us to leave a public place. Thank you very much. And I actually tried to file a complaint with Sergeant Baker when Fitzmaurice did this, because I think when the mayor comes out and tells you to leave, that's an intimidating kind of behavior. And then he turns to his administrative aide and says, take a note, Mr. Klitzner, which is the person he was talking to, won't leave, and I've told him to leave, you know. I mean, in essence, I mean, that wasn't exactly what he said to her to take the note for, but it was, he in essence was intimidating Klitzner by saying in essence that he would begin kicking a record of everything that was in the office. So what we had to do in return was make tapes, audio tapes of every single thing that happened in the office to show courts and the public later that we were not engaging in behavior. We were not, quote, talking at the top of our voices.
Well, that was my next question.
Right.
So you do have videotapes.
We have audio tapes. But unfortunately, the audio tapes are not being admitted into evidence by the judge because he doesn't want to hear all these... He doesn't want to hear 20 hours of silence or people rustling papers. He doesn't want to listen to it. And, you know, we have... And we've also had some internal problems of processing those documents. We were going to get them logged, and we never got them logged, so they can't really be properly introduced.
The tapes were never documented?
Well, the tapes were... You have to go through and hear everything, and then you have to write down what happens where, and that really never happened.
Uh-oh.
You know,
so this is an evidentiary hearing going on now?
It is an evidentiary hearing. It resumes again, as I said, tomorrow at 3 o'clock.
And they're going to decide if there's going to be a trial?
No, this is the trial.
Right. If she gets to keep the restraining order?
If we lose this one, the standard result, although it could be any result depending on what the judge wants to do, is that the order is kept in place for 3 years. Becomes a permanent injunction.
Uh-huh.
So that's the...